Back here on the Mighty 690 KGG, I'm Sam Speck with you, and for our Wildcat Wednesday, it's Barbara Ames and Jacob Weber here with us from the Wildcat Extension District. Welcome back in, as it is also September. It is Food Safety Awareness Month, and Barbara, I know you've got the tips for us.
I do.
Really, let's just go ahead and start kind of with the basics, and then kind of more of the things maybe that people didn't know about.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think it's important for us just to understand why it's important, because sometimes people say, well, I do that all the time and I've not gotten sick yet. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there are about 48 million illnesses in the United States each year that can be traced back to foodborne pathogens. And 3,000 deaths in the country on average in a year. So it is important. It costs Americans billions of dollars a year. So there are some tips. Food Safety Awareness Month is a good time to just kind of refresh ourselves on those tips, because, you know, it just takes a few minutes, but it can protect our family from a really serious illness. First thing is just hand washing. That's one of the key things that we can do, is just wash our hands with soap and warm running water before and after handling food, and then make sure we wash our cutting boards, our dishes, our countertops, our utensils, all those things with warm soap and water. Be sure to separate raw meat, seafood, and eggs from other foods in your grocery cart, in your grocery bag, and in your kitchen at home, in the refrigerator, and wherever you're working with food. And then another thing, don't rinse meat or poultry. I know years ago we used to say, you know, people would rinse their poultry and thought they were doing a good thing. But at this point, they've discovered that as you rinse that, you little drops of water, you know, splatter around the kitchen. And so you're actually spreading that bacteria. And basically the cooking process up to 165 for poultry will kill those pathogens. And so at this point, they're just saying it's not a safety step and it can spread germs around the kitchen. So
it's like throwing water on an oil fire. It doesn't do a whole lot to you. It just spreads it a little bit.
Yeah,
worse,
exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So that's something that, you know, they don't recommend anymore. And then also make sure your refrigerator stays at 40 degrees or below and get those leftovers in there within 2 hours in shallow containers so they can cool down quick enough. And if you're not going to use those leftovers within 3 or 4 days, you want to think about maybe freezing some of those instead. And then you have a meal you can pull out at some point. Some other things here. Never defrost at room temperature. We talk about that a lot. In order to safely defrost food, you can do it in the refrigerator or in cold water or in the microwave if you're going to go ahead and cook it right away. And then it's a good idea to use a food thermometer, because food is safely cooked when it reaches a high enough internal temperature to kill those harmful bacteria. And you can't really tell that by looking at it. You know, sometimes we think we can, but you can't. And the thermometer really helps me, because I have a tendency to overcook, wanting to make sure it's done. And so when I use a food thermometer, my food usually turns out better because it's not cooked quite so much. So that's maybe just me. But anyway, and then you know, like I said, these simple precautions just take a few extra minutes, but they can protect your family from serious illnesses. So,
and I think one thing that I noticed too, it was, I can't remember where I was reading it, but it said those door compartments on your refrigerator, you know, they always ask you to put your butter and your milk
and your,
eggs,
right.
Some of those. And but really, that's the first exposed to room temperature,
right.
And sometimes those hotter. Would that be kind of a tip to maybe throw your milk jug in the main compartment?
That's
of the fridge,
right.
Instead
we
of the
do
door.
Don't really recommend keeping your milk in the coldest part of the refrigerator. So, good catch there.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember exactly where I was reading that, but I didn't think of it. And it's like, I mean, they put those big compartments there.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they even put my dad's got a fancy fridge where it just opens the outside of the fridge, and then there's the compartment for the milk. I'm sure his fridge has got better refrigeration than my old 1990s status, but the door has always kind of been the spot for my yogurts, my eggs, my dairy products, and things
like
that.
But that's not really the recommended.
It's really not where it should be.
Yeah,
so
it's not really the recommended spot. Another food safety tip, here in the fall, as we're coming to the end of our gardens, and, you know, we're going to have a frost here sometime coming up in October or something, we just want to remind people that canning is not the best way to handle tomatoes from that are frost off of frost-killed vines, or you know, overripe tomatoes, because the acidity is affected by, you know, the frost-killed vines and the overripening, and so your recipe may not have enough acid there to kill all the bacteria and so forth. So we really don't recommend canning tomatoes off of frost-killed vines.
Good stuff.
So just all another
keep that in mind.
Food
and
safety
Barbara
tip.
Barbara always coming in with some good tips. And again, it's just even if you do keep an eye on your food safety and things here in September, it's just kind of good to refresh your memory on some of those tips and things like that. So Jacob, I know you've been getting some calls here this past week on some particular items. Anything that's been, you know, raising your eyebrows? Any questions that you'd like to answer? And of course, here at 251-6909, if you have a question for Jacob, we got the phone lines open for you. But Jacob, anything that you've been hearing?
Just hit and miss on some items, but pond weeds are still one of the hot topics. Moles, of course, another one. Pond weeds, you know. I know that there's some folks that are disappointed with vegetation that grows on ponds, farm ponds, and would like to see a pristine water, clear to the bottom, and that's not good. Well, okay, it's good for photography.
I was going to say, good for that picture.
For the picture, but for fish and aquatic life, a pond that has water that you can't see more than a foot down into it, foot and a half maybe, before you have no more visibility, that's really more ideal for aquatic wildlife than a clear pond. And aquatic weeds and even algae provide oxygenation, and food for not only the fish, but also fowl that are going to visit the pond or nest there. So the clear, beautiful, pristine swimming pool is for swimming pools. It's
I was gonna say, you might as well just set yourself up a swimming pool and make it look like a pond later on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I don't get too cranked about pond weeds and things that grow in the pond. But I guess if you were fishing and you get your hook tangled up in all that stuff and you can't see the bobbin going up and down, have a trouble getting that line out into the water, I can see getting a little bit cranky about that. But I think there's maybe a little bit more tolerance of the aquatic flora, so to speak, and not get too excited. There are some things, ponds that have a tendency to be heavily covered with algae, and that's an indication that there's quite a heavy nutrient load in the water itself, and that may be coming from runoff from particular areas, and it could be from agriculture fields, or it could be from lawns heavily fertilized with especially phosphate fertilizer. So there are various ailments that we might see in ponds. Some ponds just get old and shallow and then become covered with weeds, and at that point it might be a time to dredge those ponds and clean them up a little bit. And that means there's going to be a little bit of expense involved. So that's one of the questions that comes up. But Barbara and I were talking off air about pumpkins and pumpkin harvest.
And using
pumpkins in recipes and putting pumpkin in oatmeal. And I read that in Barbara's little news clip that she had there. And okay, I never thought about putting mashed pumpkin in oatmeal, but may have to try that and see how that
works. I've tried it. I was telling you that I like mashed pumpkin and maybe some dried cranberries along with that in oatmeal. And it's just the idea behind all that is just to add some flavor and some great nutrition. A lot of our seasonal fall fruits and vegetables that are coming on right now have a lot of great nutrients, and pumpkins and sweet potatoes are those dark yellow or orange colors that have lots and lots of vitamin A and vitamin C and potassium and dietary fiber and all those good things, and a lot of flavor. So We were just thinking of some ways that you could put some mashed pumpkin, like maybe in your oatmeal or in sauces or chili or something like that. So that was kind of the idea behind all of that.
Kind of thinking outside the box. I mean, my goodness, you hit October and I swear businesses are throwing pumpkin spice or pumpkin this into everything. You know what I mean? So might as well do it at home. And so pumpkin chili, is that what you said? Pumpkin mash
and
some chili?
Yeah, you can put some mashed pumpkin in some chili. About what they were recommending is a 1/4 to 1/2 cup of mashed pumpkin and maybe 15 to 16 ounces of, say, spaghetti sauce or baked beans or chili or something like that.
Almost kind of a sweet, you know, that sweeter aspect to it. I kind of like that. You know, I'm trying to think of kind of some ideas of where you could throw that elsewhere. The oatmeal, I think that probably sounds the best of them all, because I think that would go really good with just the mash in general. Just trying to think of some other ones that it would go good into. Obviously, cookies. You can't go wrong with cookies.
Oh, sure.
I mean, goodness.
And, cookies and muffins and cakes and all of that kind of thing.
All the good bakery items, certainly.
Yes.
Certainly.
And every pumpkin dreams of becoming a pie.
Exactly.
That's right. Probably the recipe that's used the most is that pie recipe, too.
Yeah, the pumpkin pie coming up here, you know, October. You got people also making them big old jack-o'-lanterns, too. So.
Yeah, jack-o'-lantern pumpkins are more for decoration. They're not quite the ideal ones for eating,
for
although you can eat them. They are very edible. Jack-o'-lantern pumpkin is actually a squash, just like a lot of other squash plants are. Some of the better pie-making squash are definitely not the jack-o'-lantern type pumpkins.
Yeah.
They're actually a large Kuchar squash is my favorite for making pumpkin pie. Butternut squash, another high quality squash, good for eating and putting in recipes. Good quality. How do you tell when a pumpkin is ready to pick or a squash is ready to pick? That's a good question. The rind. It's not like the summer squash that have a thin skin, edible skin. The rind on a pumpkin or squash becomes hardened, very hard, and almost to the point where you cannot push your thumbnail into it. And of course, if you injure it, that's going to have to callus over. But the rind becomes very hard. Oftentimes, the rind color changes in a good many squash to a typical either orange or beige. Green, dark green color. Butternut, let me see, what was the Hubbard squash? That has been the one squash that I think it has the toughest rind of anything. It'll deflect bullets out of the vine itself, stem might dry down a little bit. That would be another identifying character for a mature squash. One of the things that we want to make sure when we harvest squash is to not damage that stem that's attached to the fruit itself, because that helps protect the squash internally from decay. Stem breaks off, you're probably going to end up either throwing that squash in the compost pile within a few weeks, or you're going to have to use it fairly soon. Squash can be stored in a cool, fairly dry place. Well, not highly, terribly dry, but about 50% humidity. Cool temperatures, 50 degrees, would be great for storing squash. And some squash, like the Hubbard squash, can be stored up to several months and still have good eating quality, very good, excellent eating quality. Butternut and Hubbard are some of the longer-term storing squashes that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Now, I was going to answer your question of because I certainly don't know when a pumpkin's ready, but my grandpa always used to show me. He basically used to kind of tap, get the sound of his watermelons, of his pumpkins, of different squash out. And that's just experience. That's it. That's his experience. He knows by going up to it.
He just liked to tap on
things. Exactly, right?
Yeah.
Just like tapping on things. All right. Well, that's Jacob Weber and Barbara Ames with the K-State Extension District. Any final notes from you guys?
Okay. If you're interested in 4-H, I'd like to tell folks in the Wildcat District, the contact people here in the Independence office, Katie Townsend, and the Altamont office, Julie Traxson. In the Wilson County Fredonia office, that would be Cherry Nelson, and in the Girard office, come on.
Will.
Okay. What's his last name? Oh, we're both them.
He's new.
Spacing it, yeah.
In Will. Our defense, he's new.
Morris. Will
yeah,
Morris.
Will
there
Morris.
We got it.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, it's there somewhere.
We just had to bring it back.
Yeah.
Will Morris, certainly. Well, hey, guys, thanks so much for checking in with us, and we will speak with K-State next Wednesday.
All right, okay. Thanks.
All right, this is the Mighty 690 KGGF.